Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks Academic Muslimas. Today we're going to talk to Dr. Amina Beverly McLeod Aldeen, who is a professor emeritus of religious studies and the director of Islamic World Studies at DePaul University. She is one of the most eminent scholars on Islam in America, and her areas of expertise include Muslim women, Islamic studies, and history, geography, politics, religion, and the philosophy of Islam. She's authored several books, including African-American Islam, History of Arab Americans, Transnational Muslims in American Society, and An Introduction to Islam in the 21st Century. She's on the executive board of Inner City Muslim Action Network and on the board of Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative. We're going to talk about a host of issues, including her program that she hosts on YouTube called Critical Talk, and her scholarship over the years, her outlook on Islam in America, anti-Black racism within Islam in America, and our hopes for the future. But before we continue on to the conversation with her, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Assalamu alaikum, Amina.
Wa alaikum salam, Saba.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, definitely for me. Definitely for me. I'm so happy. I'm just going to go right ahead and ask you. I know you're the host of a show called Critical Talk, which is available on YouTube on the Muslim Network TV. And it's amazing. I recommend everybody to go check it out. It has amazing guests on it. I wanted to ask you, what is this show about? How did you get started in it? And what motivates you to keep going in this project?
Well, Critical Talk, you know, is an offshoot of what Sound Visions had as a radio station a long, long time ago, maybe 20 years ago. And I was asked to come up with a program theme, and I came up with Critical Talk, which is Critical Talk, straightforward, about any and everything. We talk about everything from the Constitution to Muslim women to Black psychology to psychology in general. We did a whole host, maybe 70 shows during the beginning of the pandemic on various topics, from healthcare to mental health care to what do we do about our elders or people eating, you know. Just everything. This coming week, I am doing a show on ISPU's latest surveys on the mosque. Mm-hmm. And then later on that week, I'll be interviewing Dr. Bilal Ware. Nice. On his work on African Islam and also what he's teaching. So it motivates me because there are very few African-American Muslim talk shows. There are some podcasts, but there's not an ongoing talk show where I can invite people or they can invite themselves and let me know about what's going on that is directly affects our community, but also directly affects the community at large and that we as a community need to know about. I have an ongoing political correspondent, Dr. Scott Hibbard from DePaul University, who brings it, you know, it's explain these terms, what is going on in the government, that kind of thing. So it's a fun show. Well, not fun, but, you know.
I know exactly what you mean by fun. I mean, it is amazing to talk to so many brilliant minds, and you're doing a wonderful job. Again, everybody should check out Critical Talk. You also have a book called An Introduction to Islam in the 21st Century, which is quite comprehensive. It's really well written. For many people, both Muslims and non-Muslims, Islam is like this static thing that was kind of revealed 1400 years ago, and then we're kind of done. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, like, why were you motivated to write this book? And then why the addition of the title 21st Century? Can you talk a bit about why we need to address Islam of the 21st century in particular?
Well, I think it is important. Well, number one, I was teaching, and in order to teach about Islam in cultures, which is one of my specialties, we found that students had to have a stack of books because there was nothing that put the majority cultures in one text. You know, there's South Asian Islam, there's Arab Islam, there's this Islam in America, there's this, but they're all kind of separated out. So we wanted to do a text that professors could use. They can use parts of it or all of it to talk about Islam in the classroom, especially after 9/11. But they can talk about African Islam and what has happened in Africa after colonialism and independence. But they could also talk about our laws affecting Muslims. They could talk about Islamophobia. There were very few books that included Iraq and Syria. So we wanted to have a comprehensive text that folk could leaf through. You know what I'm saying? Instead of, oh, well, they're there.
Yeah. Get like 15 different papers on it. Yes. Have it all in one book instead.
Yeah. Hopefully you just flip through the pages.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful reference book. You also have another book called African American Islam, which was written pre 9/11 era. And I think for a lot of non-Muslims, whatever they know of Islam exists in this post 9/11 era. And the book that you write contextualizes Islamic life within Black communities. I was wondering if you can help unpack the notion of Black Islam. What are the origins and what is the significance of this term? What is meant by it?
Well, I think that there are several things. There's been an accepted narrative put out there and taken up by many immigrants that Black Islam is somehow hetero or pseudo or something of the else Islam, but Islam in the world over these 1400 years has settled in cultures and it has taken on aspects of a culture, what is important to them, instilled some things and left other things alone, but pushed notions of social justice, etc. So one of the impetus for writing this particular text was to parse out how many different communities there are, how many different ideological positions there are, all centered around the core of Islam, and how folk were interpreting Islam for this space and time. And Black Islam moves to incorporate not just African Americans who have a particular history, but also Blacks from other places in the Americas and also on the continent of Africa. So Black Islam is a more encompassing term because it includes the Caribbean, you know, South America, Central America, and the continent.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit on that. You said, you know, for a lot of people, they've kind of accepted the narrative that Black Islam is some hyphenated Islam. And I was wondering if you could expand a little bit and talk to the issue of anti-Black racism, perhaps both within Islam, but also outside. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I think that because even though it seems like it's very old, and it came with slavery to the shores of what is now the United States. It also came to the shores of, oh, I don't know, the Caribbean and Latin and South America, you know, in the bodies of Muslims who were kidnapped or sold into slavery. And that part is important, but in terms of formal communities, we begin in the 20th century. And in that sense, it's still young, still formulating itself, still seeding itself to answer a lot of questions. And one of those questions was, why did it take on the colorations that it did in Sheikh Dawood Faisal and Elijah Muhammad and other smaller inner groups? And I think that is important because in early 20th century America, there was Father Divine, Elder Michelle. There were all of these people who were trying to put together communities who could nourish, maintain, and in some ways educate people in great migrations from the South to the North. For African Americans, it was also a redoing of psychology. You know, when you have generations, 10 of them to be exact, at least 10, in chattel slavery, you have to do a slow but firm reorientation of the mind. You know, there's a discipline, there's at the center of all of the African-American Muslim groups, there is a center of self-help. You know, what can you do to help yourself and to get rid of some of the fears while at the same time white people are lynching black people on corners in front of stores and everywhere else, the Ku Klux Klan is rampant. So the groups form themselves around the core of Islam, the disciplinary thing of changing your diet, getting rid of vices, and doing all of those things, but also standing up to the terror that was and it still is reigning.
Right. And does I suppose, like, in large part, that also kind of ties into Black liberation theology, because, you know, I mean, we talk about Black Christian liberation theology, but side by side, there's also Black Islamic liberation theology.
And they're really quite different in that Muslims don't think that there's a white something that's going to save them. That saving becomes you do for self and then Allah helps you along. A little bit different. And there is not a focus on forgiving those that enslaved you and continue to torment you. There is more of an emphasis on living a good moral life and standing up to injustice.
I love that.
Okay.
That's a good emphasis. I like that. Can you also expand on Islam as experienced in communities in North America, Latin America, and the Caribbean? You mentioned that prior. Why is it essential to focus on these diverse threads within Muslim experiences instead of, like, the homogenous view that folks often have of Islam?
Well, I think two things. One, Muslims function here at the very core of American society, in that it is African American Muslims who go to the courts with getting your name changed. Something as simple as that. Women who were in nursing and in pharmacy and other healthcare venues that enable Muslim women to wear scarves on their heads. Those were suits that came very quietly, but very firmly in terms of a present. They were not doing the thing of screaming about Islamophobia or any of those things, but managed to, and I don't want to say managed, maybe a better term is lived in American society, influencing American society, especially with even Christians have Malcolms and Abdullahs and Muhammads as names that they name their children, and all kinds of permutations on Muslim names that I guess they decided sounded good, but also more importantly, because they had meaning. Mm-hmm. One thing, Latin America and the Caribbean, there were probably as many, if not more, Muslim slaves brought to those areas. So you have Muslim communities everywhere from Cuba to the tip of South America. And to see how those communities function, to see how they are enabled inside of society and not understood as outcasts or anything. They are people who came from Spain, you know, lots of different places and the African continent to what we're calling North America, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Very lively and functional misogyny And as soon as travel became a thing, you know, you could fly into somewhere, they're all over. And I think the thing that unfortunately has happened is what goes on in the so-called Muslim world, Muslim majority states, is what influences how American, other Americans, non-Muslim Americans, understand Islam, because everybody's put into one pot except African Americans and Black Muslims from other places. There's a special racial pot for us.
And why do you think that that is the case?
Well, America is a racist country. It's built on racist notions, starting with Native Americans, First Nations. And it continues that because it gives power. It has given an interesting economy. And it is ongoing. I mean, and that comes first. 100%. So when you have an African-American Muslim, what you see first is Black.
100%. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, anti-Black racism is at the root of defining.
Well, it is. And then as the doors open in, what is it, about 1964, 65 for immigrants to come in, their anti-Black racism came with them.
True.
Yeah.
Could you expand a little bit on the anti-Black racism in the immigrant communities?
Well, all of the communities, unfortunately, have their experiences of colonialism, you know, different ways. We could call slavery a kind of colonialism. But those countries which experience British and French and Portuguese and Dutch colonialism had the European form of racism coming down, and they found it a way to divide and conquer. So I remember the first time I was in Pakistan seeing these huge billboards of light and lovely. And I'm saying, really? And folk, what is it, gori gori, you know, a celebration at weddings and stuff of whiteness. And so white becomes preferred, and the darker you are, the less your chances are of success. And they bring that with them. So you have in one of ISPU's survey, Arabs and South Asian Muslims who are of the lighter hue talking about the fact I'm white. Now, white people would say, no, you're not. I had a blow up in one of my classes about that. as one young Syrian woman was talking about being white, and one white American in my class said, oh, no, you're not.
Wow.
So you have these, you know, these negotiations and non-accommodations of whiteness as white Americans try and white Europeans try to further define what is whiteness.
Wow. I mean, this is quite powerful. I mean, how you understand yourself being so defined by anti-Black racism, the fact that this person who's from Syria wants that proximity to whiteness.
Yeah.
I want to end with kind of talking about your hopes for the future of Muslim life in Americas, specifically in the United States of America. Like, what do you see moving forward? What are your hopes for us as Muslim Americans?
Well, I hope the Muslim community has an opportunity to represent a faith tradition where racism is not at the core, that actually they have the time to spend, as the Quran says, getting to know one another in the ways that they get to know one another, but to function outside of superior, inferior, white, Black. They have the time to set a model. Now, whether they ever do that or not, is something else. I also hope I'm watching the immigrant community is on a trajectory that it probably is not good. They're, you know, it's we want to take over America. You're not taking over America. So I think a better trajectory is how can we live the life that the Quran dictates for us and move forward and have a good presentation in America, you know, set up the things that move the society along and things that help people in the society that can't help themselves, stop with a sole concern for Muslims and be concerned about the orphans, be concerned about the homeless, be concerned about not to put yourself in bright lights, but to really move to put the wonderful things that are in Islamic philosophy and Kalam at work in the society.
True. Wow. That's powerful to see basically liberation within Islam.
Yeah.
Those are some powerful words. Well, thank you so much. That was a beautiful conversation. I'm so indebted to you for coming on and having this conversation with me.
Well, I'm indebted to you. I never thought you got me thinking about stuff. I never really, really, you know, I entertain it, but not focused. So well, you made me focused.
No, you have inspired an entire generation, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you. And I look forward to your talks on Critical Talks.
Oh, please. And I have every intention of having you there so we can talk about some other things. And let me ask, where can people find this podcast?
This podcast, thank you so much for asking. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. So it's on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, you name it. It should be on every podcast platform. I'm not the best with advertising. So it kind of is dependent on word of mouth.
Okay, well, I'm going to let as many people as I can know. And this has been such an honor.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Assalamu alaikum. And I will talk to you soon. Wa alaikum salam.